PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I told her goodbye, my Coney Island baby. Farewell, my own true love. I'm gonna go away and leave you. Never gonna see you any.
Frank Zappa once said, "It isn't necessary to imagine the world ending in fire or ice. There are two other possibilities. One is paperwork, the other's nostalgia." This hour, a look at looking back. Because we all remember the good old days, don't we?
Get it!
But first, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. What you're hearing may sound like the funk music that came out of the early 60s, but in fact, it's brand new. The band is Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. And they're a strange group in many ways. Sharon Jones, the lead singer, is a black woman in her late 40s. The band members are mostly white and young, very young. But as James Brown once said, "I don't really care what people think. I just do my own thing."
Ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, the super soul sister with the magnetic je ne sais quoi, Miss Sharon Jones!
Steve Paulson with Soul Sister Number One.
What do these little young white boys know about funk? And once I got inside the studio, my mouth just like dropped, and I literally had to close it up.
Well, I have to ask you about this because, I mean, I've just seen the pictures of your band members, and
oh, see,
they are little white boys. I mean, that sounds
little
like
white boys.
I mean, what did you think when you first saw them? I mean, these guys playing funk.
Gabe was like 23 or something like that. But the drummer, my drummer Homer, was like 16. He was still in high school. It was like amazing. I'm like, what?
Hey, Ben.
What, nigga?
Did you hear about the new epidemic going around? Every man, woman, and child is catching it. It's spreading from town to town. It's called the Dap Dip, and they say you get it in your pants.
Oh, hell, Biggie, that ain't no epidemic. That's a brand new dance.
One thing that I find just amazing about your songs is they sound like they were recorded decades ago. How do you get that sound?
It's amazing. We literally built our studio. We got this old apartment building in Bushwick. And they went inside and gutted it out. Bosco literally put in the whole system, the boards. I did the electrical plugs. We read books. He told me what to do. All the sockets and everything we plugged in, it worked. We literally built that studio. And when we record live. Everyone plays at the same time. We will have like the drums or the, you know, percussions in this room. The horns may be standing behind this partition thing. And usually I'm in the room right where he's mixing the board down, like, shh, be quiet. And I can record in there. And so it's all done. And like they did, I guess, back in the days when James Brown and JB's used to record in the late 60s.
Now, are you using reel-to-reel machines? I mean,
this is not digital recording here. No digital recording at all. All reel-to-reel. I hope we can buy in tape, because if they ever run out of tape, we're lost.
Well, it's interesting because you really can hear that. I mean, it really does have that sound of those songs that came out in the 60s and 70s. I mean, I guess I didn't know that you could still do that.
Yeah. I mean, you hear my vocals. They're just as normal, just as like I'm on the stage singing. And that's what I like. I don't like all that reverb and echo and, you know, you put this on the voice to make me hit a note. You don't need to make me hit a note. I can hit my own notes. You know, I don't need them enhanced. And so I like that. So it's my time.
How long do I have to wait for you, honey, before a girl like me can move on? Ooh, baby, tell me how long do I have to wait for you, honey, before I can say that you're gone every hour.
Well, one of the most amazing things is that you have released a bunch of your singles as 45s and then on albums on vinyl. I mean, I didn't know anyone still did that.
I know. We're not the only ones, but a lot more like independent record labels are picking up on this vinyl thing. But I'm glad Bosco stood his grounds and never gave up on the vinyl. when you buy the album and you look at it, it's like, whoa. Well, then from the 60s, bro. Right from the 90s.
But, you know, I mean, putting songs out on 45s or even on vinyl, that must be kind of a risk. I frankly don't know many people who still own record players.
That's here in the U.S. In Europe, I mean, when we go away, we sell our vinyls in 45s. Like, we run out. We'll come back sometime maybe with a few CDs, maybe. But the vinyls go in Europe. People love them.
Some love makes you helpless. Some love makes you strong. And some love makes you do right. And some love makes you do wrong. Believe me when I tell you, I got the kind of love that's gonna make you higher, baby, than what you're dreaming of. And I'm gonna give it to you, oh baby.
My love.
And I'm gonna give it to you, oh baby.
My love.
You're gonna get it.
Now, one thing that I think would be tempting to do these kinds of songs the way you've done it, I mean, because you're recreating this old sound, is it would be really easy to do covers of classic Aretha Franklin, you know, or James Brown songs, but that's not what you're doing.
No, we're not doing it. We may take a song, and when you hear me sing this song, you say, oh, that reminds me of Otis Redding, or that reminds me of Aretha.
Now, one thing you do cover is a Janet Jackson song, What Have You Done For Me Lately?
You know, that song, believe it or not, we got an email. Someone says, so Janet Jackson did Sharon Jones cover? So they literally thought that, yeah, Janet did my cover.
So why did you want to cover that song?
All right, Janet Jackson, I love Janet. Don't get me wrong. Listen to her. I think she can dance well, you know, all that stuff. Great little body. You know, but her vocals, you know, they put so much on enhancing her voice. And she whispers, I think. You know, I'm like, what is she saying? You know, so they enhance and turn around. I never knew what she was saying on this song. All I knew is, what have you done for me lately? And all the other stuff. So I didn't know the words. So when he gave me those words, I was like, okay. And I just thought, went there with a turn. When you would pay for me. And I did it my way.
There was a time.
Speaking of covers, on your new album, you actually cover Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. I mean, covering This Land Is Your Land in an R&B version? Yeah, how did that happen?
That's what we do.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Now, when Woody Guthrie wrote This Land Is Your Land, that was a very political song. Do you see your version as being political?
It's still political. We haven't changed any lyrics. Those are the same lyrics. We just sang the verse of the lyrics that they don't usually sing a lot, you know. And it's the same thing, because that was done a lot, like when the war in Vietnam, and same thing going on now, this war, what we were into. It has a meaning. It is political, and it has that. Like I said, is this land ours? You know. If it's loud, why they got a sign up that says private property? And I can't go there, you know. So I understand the song.
This land was made for you and me. This land is your land.
Now, I have to ask you about your career, because you've had a really unusual career. I mean, you, from what I've heard, you, sang in your church, and then you worked for years as a prison guard. And then, discovered after that at some point?
You know, coming up, in the certain times in the 80s, they told me I didn't have the look. They told me I was too dark-skinned, I was too short, that I need to bleach my skin and stuff like that. And, you know, and lose some weight, but that really can... You know, it can really turn you, you know? And I looked like what Stephanie Mills went through when she did The Wiz. She wasn't chosen to do the movie version, so they chose Diana Ross because they told her she didn't have a look. You know, she didn't look good. And so the same thing, to tell her she didn't have the look, tell me I didn't have a look. But I felt God gave me a gift. And one day people are going to accept me for who I am, the same short, dark-skinned, pleasantly plump woman. And that's it's my time now.
Yes, yes, thank you very much. We are the Dap Kings. Right about now, we're going to take a short pause. Give you a little bit of time to flip the record on. Maybe run into the kitchen and fix yourself a drink.
Sharon Jones and the Dap King. Their latest LP is entitled Naturally. Steve Paulson spoke with Miss Sharon Jones. And yes, the music for this interview came off a good old-fashioned vinyl. Do you have a favorite song from back in the day? Send us an email and tell us your story. Go to ttbook.org. Later this hour, a closer look at the epitome of innocence, Norman Rockwell.
Innocence itself can be not a way of repudiating sexuality, but a way of eroticizing something without admitting that you're doing it.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Since 1961, artist William Christenberry has been returning home every summer to Hale County, Alabama. He doesn't go to visit family or friends. He goes, instead, to photograph long-forgotten buildings in the county's hidden corners. To mark the passage of time, he's been taking photos of the same structures year after year. His favorite building sits alone in a forest. It's totally covered in fake red brick siding. Ann Strangechamps asked Christenberry how he found the little red building.
I like to range. In this case, I took a country road off the main road. It was a paved road, but it was a road where you very, very seldom see any other traffic, any cars or trucks, out into this area of what is a beautiful pine forest. And there is some, you know, there are lumber companies that work there, but ordinarily you don't see anybody. And I came around a curve in the road, and here was this, for me, just exquisite little piece of vernacular architecture, this little building that I thought was most interesting because the door of it, closed, of course, was covered with the same fake brick siding.
Yeah, so in your photographs, it looks like somebody's bricked up the door.
Yes, yes, exactly. I don't know if that was deliberate or tongue-in-cheek or whatever, but I thought, boy, that's wonderful.
What is it that makes you think of that as an exquisite little building? Because a lot of people wouldn't look at it twice.
Well, I like how time and the elements alter things and make things oftentimes more interesting. But just the proportions of that building, it's not a great piece of architecture. By the way, for years I didn't know its function because, as I said, I never saw anyone there when I was there. I guess it was about 10 years ago I found out that it was a polling place, that is, where people working out in that country, in the forest, and eking out a living in a small farming plot, these people would come on voting day and cast their vote rather than going about 15 miles to the county seat. But before that, I finally discovered that many, many years ago, it was a one-room schoolhouse.
Wow.
One-room schoolhouse. And now it's just there.
Have you found that most people down in the areas where you go to photograph, do they appreciate, do they understand your photographs, or do they think you're doing something kind of weird?
That's a good question. Some are supportive and some are skeptical or, unfortunately, think that I'm making fun or demeaning the South, which is quite the opposite.
Because you're choosing to photograph these little run-down kind of shack-like places?
Well, they aesthetically, again, they interest me. My region, where I'm from, West Central Alabama, is rich with great antebellum mansions left over from Civil War days, and many of them are well kept. And they are beautiful, but what mankind does, especially again with country architecture, out of necessity, with what's at hand, just intrigues me no end. And the fact that in most vernacular architecture cases, you never see two that are alike, two buildings that are alike. So, yes, I've been criticized by some of painting a picture, so to speak, of the South that's not what some people appreciate. But I think if one really looks carefully at the work in all of its aspects, in terms of the painting, the sculpture, the drawing, and of course the photographs, I think they would really see or sense that this is a love affair.
One of the things that's so moving about looking at your photographs of buildings, these small, often very poor buildings, is seeing the series, you know, over the course of the years, and seeing, in some cases, the changes, what happens to some of these buildings. There's one I'm thinking about that starts out as, oh, maybe it's just a little juke joint. I think you see the...
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, out front, and then as the years go by, it becomes a barbecue place.
Right.
Well, you describe that.
Well, initially, I think the first picture I made of it was 67 or 68. It was Woods Radio and TV Repair. So from Woods Radio and TV Repair, it became the Barbecue Inn. And that was a very, very good example of a juke joint. Because on Friday and Saturday night, there was wonderful blues music and wonderful barbecue in the Barbecue Inn. And then in the 90s, I was there, I think it was 97, and it had burned. They had a fire. And the structure, the brick structure, at least the exterior, was still pretty much intact. But then the next year I go back, and it was nothing but that concrete slab there. It was gone.
I have to tell you, going through the pages and seeing those photographs one after another, the first pages when it's Woods Radio and TV, and then when it becomes the juke joint, there's such a sense of the life that goes on in this place, even though there are no people in any of your pictures. But you just have a sense of the life that's contained in this place. And when you turn the page and you get to the picture where the building's gone, it makes you gasp. You know, there's this feeling like the breath just got sucked out of you.
I'll tell you a quick side to that. You're absolutely right. And that suite, that group of pictures that we're talking about, the Barbecue Inn, was exhibited in a gallery here in Washington just a few days. This was not planned. The exhibition was already in the works right after September the 11th. And a lot of people were brought to tears by that concrete slab. They identified with that great disaster that our country had experienced. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They identified with that.
This must have happened to you more than once, to go back and find that a building you've been photographing for, you know, 20 years or more is suddenly gone.
It happens almost annually now. Almost annually, something that I've been involved with in every way, with the camera, with drawing and painting. I go back, can't wait to get there and deal with it annually, and it's gone. And some nondescript mobile home on its site. At least where the Barbecue Inn was, was not anything on that slab until last summer when I was there, and it had become a car wash. They had a beautiful, big, black, shiny Buick car just having been washed, just gleaming out there on that concrete slab.
William Christenberry's book of photographs is simply called William Christenberry, and Strange Champ spoke with him. A year-long retrospective of his work can be seen at the Smithsonian Institute. To view the photos discussed in this interview, please go to our website at www.ttbook.org.
I had been photographing, actually right up the street from the Barbecue Inn, another country store, and no one was around. It was kind of strange. It was a very quiet day, and I'm under the dark cloth, that is, with the big camera, focusing, and I heard no footsteps, nothing. And when I took the cloth off my head, right to my left, it startled me. It didn't scare me, but startled me was this man. And he was beautiful, purple-black skin, as you see so often in African-American people in the Deep South. Purple-black. And he was dressed in a white short-sleeve starch shirt, white starch, white pants, white shoes, freshly polished, and a big wide-brim white hat. And he said to me, "You like that old building, son?" I said, "Yes, sir." "You ought to see my house." More out of courtesy, I said, "Well, sir, when I finish here, I'd be pleased to see your house." So in a few minutes, I'd finished and broke down the camera and put everything in the car, and he got in beside me, and he says, "Just down that road, about 2 miles. And I started down the road, and then I noticed that his left arm was missing from right below the cuff of the shirt. But I didn't say anything. And in a minute, he says to me, "Pull over on the shoulder of the road, son. That's my house. I built that house with one arm." So we got out, and he wanted to show me inside. And we went in the back door, which was fine. Little red earth path back to the back door. And then my heart really sank because there was no floor. It was just red earth. And a beat-up old mattress over in one corner, some broken chairs. And we chatted a little while, just made small talk. And I said, "Sir, do you mind if I photograph your house?" He said, "Oh, I'd be so pleased. Yes, please, I would be happy for you to. Please." So I went out and set up the big camera, the 8x10, in front of the house, and I made the picture. And I thanked him and left, thanked him profusely. And I drove away, and when we got back to Washington a week or so later and I saw the proof print, it was okay. Technically, it was sound, properly focused, decently composed, but it did not resonate with what I'd experienced there. Now, let me be the first to say, I don't know if it's possible for me or anyone else to have captured that moment. Maybe a poet, certainly a poet could write about this. So I said to myself, "Well, I'll go back next year." Next year, pretty much to the same day. I get there, and I get out of the car, and I start walking down that little red earth path. And a man next door, to my right, came rushing across the lawn. Rushing. And he stopped at the fence edge, and he said, "You looking for Mr. So-and-so?" I said, "Yes, sir." "He died. He froze to death last winter." And I've never been able to go back there.
This hour, we're discussing nostalgia. And no discussion on nostalgia would be complete without a look at the work of Norman Rockwell. His Saturday Evening Post covers have been burned into the American psyche. and reproductions of them adorn the walls of millions of American homes and offices. But is Rockwell's art as innocent as it seems? Richard Halpern is the author of Norman Rockwell, The Underside of Innocence. He says, there's more to Rockwell than many of us are willing to admit. So, was Rockwell adding a subtext to his work?
Yes, I do think that, though I'm not sure I'd call it a subtext, because the subtext suggests that it's hidden beneath something else. And I actually think that those things he includes are right there in plain sight, but nevertheless, people sometimes choose not to see them because they have this preconstructed idea of what Rockwell is, and also of who Rockwell was, and the idea that there might be, for instance, in some cases, a kind of sexual content to his work is quite disturbing to them.
Yeah. I think maybe we need to talk about an example because, well, for instance, the picture that is on the cover of the book that you're just putting out. Tell me about the picture.
It's called Girl at Mirror, and I think it's one of Rockwell's most instantly recognizable images. A girl, probably around 12 years old, she's sitting in an attic before a large mirror, and she's done her hair up. She's holding a magazine with Jane Russell looking out of it. She's clearly tried to make herself look like Jane Russell, and she's gazing into the mirror with a very complicated expression on her face, which expresses at once disappointment because she's clearly not Jane Russell, but also a kind of incipient sense that she might be beautiful someday. And it's very much a painting about the nostalgia of lost childhood, about the passing from childhood to an adult state, which it sees as loss in some ways. The painting, which is an unusual thing for Rockwell, is dark through most of it. Most of the attic is unlit. There's a small lit space in the center, but the moment is thick with the shadows of loss. Now, it's a delicate subject because now we're talking about sexuality in relation to a pretty young girl, and I think it becomes a delicate matter.
You know, what's odd about it, it seems to me, I don't think this will come as a surprise to you. What's interesting is that you force, by this discussion, the viewer to look at this and think not about anything that Rockwell did in particular. There's no overt sexuality to this, but you force us to look at it recognizing, I suppose, the fact that we have looked at other pictures that are less innocent than this, and there is a relationship.
Yes, and I think some of Rockwell's work would probably have trouble being printed today if it wasn't already known that Norman Rockwell's name was attached to it and that it therefore partook of a kind of innocence by association. There's a famous painting called Before the Shot, which I think people also know, of a young boy getting ready to receive an injection in the doctor's office, and he's pulling his pants down and he's sort of exposed the upper part of his buttocks and he's staring into a diploma on the wall. And when I've run this by people, well, I get two reactions. One is, you're making this up. This is just your own sort of perverted imagination ruining Rockwell. The other is that, well, it seems like that to us today, but we live in different times.
It's an interesting subject, isn't it? Nostalgia is so appealing to all of us. We all remake our pasts. We look back at things and see, on a good day, anyway, the things that were very pleasant. There isn't any way to really do that, though, is there?
It's funny that you should say that, because you'd think that this would be a time that was ripe for nostalgia, you know, especially in a post-9/11 world, that people would be more overtly nostalgic for a time when they didn't have to think about those things. I think there is a real rebirth of the notion of American innocence in the wake of 9/11, but it doesn't necessarily take a nostalgic form. And interestingly, Rockwell enters even into this because shortly after 9/11, the New York Times reprinted a series of Norman Rockwell images, subtly altered to reflect in some ways the tragedy of 9/11. For instance, one of his most famous images is entitled Freedom from Fear. It's one of the four Freedom series he did during World War II. It's an image of two children asleep in bed in a middle-class home, and their parents are looking over them in a kind of solicitous way. And the father's holding a newspaper which disturbingly announces the bombing of London. And the point of the painting, which Rockwell himself called a rather smug idea, was that we in the United States didn't have to worry about that sort of thing, that war was what took place somewhere else. So the New York Times reprinted that image, but for the original paper, it had an image of its own edition the day after 9/11, as if to say, there is no freedom from fear anymore. But that kind of Rockwellian, that simpler more innocent, safer Rockwellian world is both being invoked as a kind of desirable place we'd like to escape to, but at the same time recognized as something that we can no longer escape to. It's no longer available to us in quite the same way.
Richard Halpern is the author of Norman Rockwell, The Underside of Innocence. Have an opinion or a story about Norman Rockwell? Send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. Later this hour, novelist Jane Hamilton on nostalgia and writing.
There's a last moment in the book that I think is an example of the best and purest kind of nostalgia, and that's where you experience something beautiful and it remains beautiful and you remember it clearly and you can never get back.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When it comes to nostalgia, moms rule. The smell of baking cookies, the hum of a lullaby. And that nostalgia gets magnified when a mother passes away. But can you be nostalgic for your mom and miss her dearly if she isn't dead? What if she's standing right next to you? Hannah Palin understands these questions. Her mother died and was replaced by, well, her mother.
Boom, 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 goodbye, my Coney Island baby. Farewell, my own true love.
There's something about that experience that was very freeing because it was just a typical Friday morning for me, you know, and all of a sudden by the end of the day I was almost dead.
Turn again, so goodbye.
15 years ago, my mother had a brain aneurysm when she was only 46 years old. I've come to refer to it as the day my mother's head exploded. For those who don't know, and I didn't either, a brain aneurysm is a bulging spot on the wall of a brain artery, kind of like a thin balloon that can pop at the slightest provocation. When that happens, 50% of people die within minutes. The mother I grew up with died that day and was replaced by an entirely different person who just happens to have the same memories and body and family and address as my dead mother.
Oh, I know what we can do. We'll sing, Hannah.
Okay,
oh,
okay, ready?
Bum, bum, bum,
goodbye, my Coney Island baby. Hello, my own true love.
That's my mother and I singing together. My mother never used to sing. Now, she'll erupt into song at the mere hint of an attentive audience. A few years ago, she branched out into composition and wrote a song about Wendy's because she loves going there so much. Last year, she got a tattoo above her left knee, a little red heart on a green stem. She always wears a pair of Groucho Marx glasses when she picks me up from the airport. I tell myself, my mother wasn't always like this. My mother used to be very proper, very meticulous, very aware of social conventions. The ones that usually discourage people from wearing Groucho Marx glasses while singing Hey, Good Lookin' in the middle of an airport.
It was Friday, the 20th of August, and I woke up with a bad headache. And in the past, I go to an aerobics class, and my headache would go away. And it was just like magic. It was great. And I went to the aerobics class, and I worked out a little bit, and the headache just kept getting worse and worse. I was really overcome by this headache, you know, and somebody took it upon themselves to call 911, and I was laying on the couch, and all these little men came in with a stretcher and whisked me off to St. Francis Hospital in Beacon. And that's the last thing I remember for 4 months.
When I finally arrived by my mother's bedside, my stepfather led me into the tiny room where my mother lay hooked up to every conceivable wire and monitor. I took her hand just to let her know that I was finally there, and she responded with a surprisingly tight squeeze. She knew her only child was there, and her spirit wanted to let me know how happy she was, but her fragile body just couldn't handle it. Every monitor in the room went crazy. Alarm bells went off. The room became this living thing, hissing and beeping, consuming my mother's lifeblood. Nurses and doctors filled the room. My mother tightened her grip on my hand. And then I fainted. It turns out that was the second time my mother died and was revived. The first was in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. Eventually, her condition stabilized. She was moved into neurological intensive care. It was this large room staffed by two nurses working with three other patients who came and went with regularity, stroke victims, head injuries, cerebral hemorrhages. While my mother stayed put until they could finally operate to repair her aneurysm sometime in October. I was in a new age phase at this point in my life, so I insisted on putting healing crystals under her pillow and playing tapes of ocean waves and massaging her feet to make sure the chi was flowing. I'd sit outside in the sunshine and meditate, trying to reach my mother on the astral plane, but the only message I ever received was that she was still deciding whether to stay or go. In early November, my mother had been moved into a regular hospital room, and she was able to sit up and talk a little bit and was conscious, although not exactly coherent. One day, I couldn't help but ask my mother where she thought her spirit had gone while the rest of her lay unconscious at the Westchester Medical Center. She told me she'd been in Vietnam.
Well, I remember that I was a little old man in Vietnam, and I grew vegetables. It has something to do with reincarnation, I think. I don't know if that was a previous life, or that's the life I'm going to, or what, but it was so far away from anything I know now. I know nothing about vegetables, and I know nothing about Vietnam, and I know nothing about being a little old man, but that's what it was.
When Christmas came around, my mother was still just the shell of a person. She could barely talk. She still had a feeding tube coming out of her stomach. She needed help going to the bathroom. She was using a walker. Really, she should not have been outside of a nursing facility.
I had to learn to walk again. I had to learn to climb stairs. I had to learn to read again. But I had to learn to do everything all over again, because I just had to start from scratch almost. It was a real weird sensation being 46 years old and having to learn to walk again.
Over the months, I had become my mother. I taught myself to cook because she'd been a gourmet. I kept the house immaculate because she always had. My father and I talked about what we'd done that day over a glass of wine, or on really bad days, a martini, because that was his routine with my mother. I began to see for the first time that my stepfather was a really great husband, and I enjoyed his friendship a lot. But the better my mother got, the less my father needed me to fill that role, so the more I became the cantankerous, argumentative stepdaughter again. It was just really time to go home. In February, my mother was released from the hospital. In March, my grandmother came to take over the caregiving duties, and I returned to Chicago to pick up my life where I left off. When I returned home, I found myself grieving and feeling really guilty about it. I ordered myself to have patience, to wait it out. I was her daughter. She needed me. And then slowly, very slowly, this other person began to emerge.
I used to be very perfectionist-oriented. Now, if things are perfect, that's nice. If they're not so perfect, it's okay.
It's all just okay.
Yeah, everything is okay. I love sex now. I wasn't too crazy about it before. I don't know what the difference is, but I'm just more open to that kind of thing now.
You also like to sing now.
Oh, yes, I love to sing.
I don't remember you singing before.
No. After the accident, I could barely talk. I decided that singing would help me get my voice back. It made me feel good, too.
My mother's illness was one of those moments when time stops, when normal disappears, when you marvel that everyone else in the world can still laugh and go to the movies and complain about the weather. That's an explosion. In those moments, you can see life happen. It has clarity and meaning in the midst of all of its horror and pain. But then those moments pass, and you're consumed by the trivia of daily life once again. Sometimes, when I'm overwhelmed by the task of making my way through the world, I try to focus on the fact that the electric bill does not matter. The idiot glued to their cell phone does not matter. The mind-numbing day job truly does not matter. But welcoming the strange and the different, being open and available for my husband, my friends, my family, experiencing love and laughter as often as possible, that's what matters. Because it can all be taken away in one brilliant flash.
Do you feel different than other people?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how other people feel. But I do know that I don't worry about death at all. Not at all. Because I've kind of seen it and I've been there, you know. And that's very liberating.
Did you have any memory of near-death experience?
No. A lot of people have asked me that, but I didn't.
Didn't see the white light or
no.
Go over on the other side or anything like that?
Well, not unless being a farmer, a vegetable farmer in Vietnam is the other side. You know, that could be what heaven's all about, being a vegetable farmer in Vietnam. You know, maybe that's the whole thing.
Hannah Palin lives in Seattle, Washington, and works as a film archivist. Mom is retired and lives in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to the public radio website transom.org for use of this piece.
Aside from our own hothouse, there were no signs that the sexual revolution was on its way.
Novelist Jane Hamilton.
The Catholic girls in their plaid skirts and knee socks and loafers, their sprayed hair and black eye makeup, moved in an impenetrable herd on their way to school. None of the mothers could have been temptresses, none of them the type to have illicit sex leaning against laundry chutes or in commuter trains, no falling backward into swimming pools at a cocktail party for the squaws of 400 Grove. Our large, soft, graying mothers rang their bells and called one continuous name. Kevin, Dorothy, Stacy, Peter, Michaeline, Patrick, Chrissy, Susan. It seemed to me that that was what most mothers lived for, to call and call day after day. They'd sent their children out to play and wanted them back. They didn't seem to be reading The Feminine Mystique or The Second Sex out of curiosity, as Julia McIver was, weren't becoming enraged about their subjugation, raising their fists and storming the streets like the women in New York City. They weren't inventing consciousness raising, and they weren't either mending or cleaning or cooking. They were calling for us. Up and down the alley, they were so comfortably unattractive and worn that now, in my mind's eye, they have a sheen that is something like beauty.
It's novelist Jane Hamilton reading from a new book called When Madeline Was Young. Steve Paulson sat down with Jane Hamilton to talk about the varieties of nostalgia, especially literary nostalgia.
I like to think that it's a type of nostalgia, the kind where, you know, you're looking back and you realize that things have a certain rosy tint to it. And you've inserted yourself into that rosy-tinted picture, but you know you're doing it. So somehow it's more legitimate. You know, I mean, I think there are several flavors of nostalgia. You have the kind where you simply insert yourself into a Norman Rockwell picture. And it, of course, didn't happen that way. So there's a certain amount of sentiment involved in that and a lie to your own past.
Well, I want to pursue this idea of nostalgia because I know for a lot of writers, that's a dirty word. You know, it conjures up sentimentality, maybe schmaltz, and some people will want to run a million miles away from that.
But I do think, you know, in thinking about all the books that many of the books I love, I have to think that nostalgia is a great propelling force, or at least a little part of the kernel that is part of the reason the book comes into being. I think there are a few books that perhaps were not written with nostalgia in mind. For example, The Things They Carried. I don't think Tim O'Brien has any sense of longing for the war, and he's writing that book out of a pure sense of outrage. But most books I can think of really have, at least the books I love, there's a sense of deep longing.
And if you didn't have a miserable life, especially when you were growing up, I mean, how can you not look back fondly and probably
true.
At times romanticizing about
Absolutely.
Some things that happened
Absolutely.
Before?
Absolutely. But then, you know, there's the Proustian kind of nostalgia where you're looking back to suffering and you realize that when you suffered, it was the greatest time of your life. And you were never as alive then, now, as you were then. So there's that kind of nostalgia too, sort of glorifying the bad times.
Does that resonate at all for you?
To me, I have experienced, I think, what is probably the saddest kind of nostalgia, and that is where you were young. In the moment, your experience was very, very beautiful, and then you grow up and you look back and you realized you were an absolute idiot to have enjoyed what you were enjoying at that time. And so it's kind of like a reverse nostalgia. The beautiful thing has become sullied, not because it was a bad thing or because you've learned something that was a secret then or anything. It's just that you're wiser and you realize that instead of going out with the beautiful boy, you should have been reading Catullus or, you know, spending your time in a way that would have had a benefit for the years now.
I don't know if you've had this experience. I actually, a couple of years ago, I was sort of thinking a lot about this, and I was thinking, you know, I want to contact some of these people, some of my really good friends back from grade school. I went back and I looked a couple up, and it was fun to see them, but it didn't really click.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's something a little unsettling about that.
There is, and I think that you know each other really well in a certain way, and you have this shared pool of memories. And so if you get together for a short time, you completely go back into that time and revisit everything, and it's touching and it's funny. But it's very difficult then to carry that new relationship forward. In my experience, it tends to just fizzle out. And so there you are with this kind of crystallized relationship, and it's there in the museum.
I'm curious about your take on this idea of nostalgia and how this is figured into other books that you've read, other books that you've appreciated over the years. Are there particular scenes or passages that really stand out to you?
Well, one of my favorite books, and one I go back to kind of every year, is Who Will Run the Frog Hospital by Laurie Moore. And there's a last moment in the book that I think is an example of the best and purest kind of nostalgia. And that's where you experience something beautiful and it remains beautiful and you remember it clearly and you can never get back. There was an April afternoon when I was in the 10th grade that the girls' choir had to meet for its final rehearsal before the spring concert. The sun was pouring in through the gym windows, and when we took our places on the bleachers, we were standing in it, like something celestial lowered in. Our director, Miss Field, began to wave her arms at us, and a strange spell came over our throats. Our nerves tightened, and all the bones of our ears fell in line. It was Miss Field's own arrangement of a Schubert rhapsody, and the notes, for once, took flight. Couldn't catch Syl's eye. She was standing over with the sopranos, but it didn't matter. I didn't have to, because this wasn't personal. This singing, this light, this was girls. After weeks of rehearsal, celebrating the ethereal work of their voices, the bell-like, bird-like, child sound they could still make so strongly in unison. Strung along the same wire of song, we lost ourselves. Out of separate rose and lavender mouths, we formed a single living thing, like a hyacinth. It seemed even then a valedictory chorus to our childhood and struck us deep in the brain and low in the spine, like a call, and in its wave and swell lifted us, I swear, to the ceiling in astonishment and bliss. We sounded that beautiful. All of us could hear it. Aloft in the midst of it, no boys, no parents in the room, no one else to tell us, though we never managed to sound that beautiful again. In all my life as a woman, which began soon after and not unrichly, I have never known such a moment, though sometimes in my brain I go back to that afternoon to relive it, sail up there again toward the acoustic panels, the basketball hoops, and the old oak clock, the careful harmonies set loose from our voices, so pure and exact and light, we wondered later, packing up to leave, how high and fast and far they had gone.
Wow. And I suppose when you really think about nostalgia in its purest form, it does have this double-edged quality.
I mean, it does.
So wonderful, but such tremendous loss, too.
Such loss. Oh, it's just awful.
Well, it raises interesting questions about the role of memory, then, because you don't have to go back and remember this stuff. We don't have to in our regular lives. But
yes, but if you're in your car and you're listening to the radio and Barry Manilow comes on, you know, oh, Mandy, oh, you came. I mean, there you are. You're back in seventh grade. You can't help it.
Jane Hamilton's new novel is called When Madeline Was Young. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Death by Nostalgia, program number 108B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strain Champs, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Carrillo Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.